Hey y'all, you are about to listen to a very special year anniversary celebration of this podcast, The Corner Store. Tar Mahadevan and I recorded 3 live episodes at a pop-up we did at Emporium in Logan Square in Chicago. You are about to hear the second night. We had a little bit of technical difficulty up top, and so some of the audio gets chopped, but it sounds very crispy. So shout out to our producers, shout out to WGN Radio, shout out to the sponsor of the podcast and the pop-up, Stolen Spirits, and thank you all, for real, for listening to this for now going on a year. We really look forward to bringing you more conversations with, I think, some of the finest minds of the generation. If there are people who you want to have on the show, who you want to hear from, please let us know. Tara and I and the whole team are very grateful for all your ears and would love to hear from you. So please be in tune and enjoy this incredible episode with Nichelle Pugh from the John Walt Foundation and Mara Enya, who is running for mayor. Thanks for rocking with us.
I grew up down on California, Madison, down by United Center, 2219 West Warren. That's where I was brought up.
Okay. All right. Yeah. And what do you do in the world?
I work at the Illinois College of Optometry. I'm a records coordinator in the registrar's office.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. That's my day job.
Right. Because you also have a whole other career of running this incredible foundation, and we'll get there. We'll talk about it. But maybe we could start, if that's okay, by just talking about who John Walt is.
Okay, John Walt. I didn't know who John Walt was for a long time. I knew Walt.
Right.
I found out who John Walt was because I had a side. What is this? Side door or something that they was ordering. He was ordering food or something, and the guy's texting like, "Your food is here, John," on my phone. And I'm like, "Who is John?" And he's like, "You know, you ordered this food. I'm out front." And I'm like, "Yeah, you got the wrong person." And so I send the guy back, and then Walt comes upstairs. He said, "Ma, I ordered us some food." And I'm like, "What food from?" And he was like, "Sad, you know, whatever it was." And I'm like, "Yeah, some guy said John." And I told him no. And he was like, "Yeah, Ma, that's my name." I'm like, "Since when?" So he didn't change his name to John Walton. I didn't know it.
So is that how you began to know that he was up to other things? I mean,
no, I didn't even know. I knew that he was doing music and everything, but I didn't know that was the stage name that he went by. I thought he was just going by Walt.
Well, where did John come from? Because Dinner with John was also an alias he used. it's such like a normal name, you know?
It is a normal name. One thing, when he was, I want to say maybe in like first or second grade, he was going to this... I have 3 children. Walter is the oldest. Tatiana is my middle child. And Aaliyah is the baby. Walter and Tatiana were going to this summer program. My daughter, she was 6, so I picked her up. So I sent him to pick Walt up. And he's like, "Well, they said he's not here." I'm like, "What do you mean he's not here? I dropped both of them off, and I came and picked Tatiana up, and I left Walter there." He said he wanted to stay. And he was like, "No, he's not here. He's not here." So he's, you know, angry with these people. "You lost my nephew. His name is Walter." They said, "We don't have anybody by that name." My brother's like, he's furious because he's picking up his nephew that's in like first or second grade, and nobody knows who this kid is. And it's like, Max. Walter made up the name Max and was telling these people that his name was Max. I filled out all the paperwork and everything in his name. So why would you let this child change his name to Max?
He was always very creative, of course.
He was creative.
When did you kind of come to know that he was a part of this crew, many of whom is comprised of some of your, you know, family members or, you know, young people that you knew?
Well, I want to say Walt was in high school senior year. senior year of high school, he started going down to my uncle's house a lot. I always worked like multiple jobs and things just to make sure that my kids can go. I sent them to private school and everything, so I just wanted to make sure that they had the best, and the best way that I can do that was to work the way that I did. So I didn't really have opportunity to take them and let them hang out and everything. So they actually, while in Saba, they ended up having the same scholarship. High school, they did Link Unlimited. And one day, Walt came home. He was like, yeah, you know, I saw Malik. So Malik is his that's not his, well, that's his middle name. So, but we family calls him Malik. And he's like, I saw Malik at Link today. And I'm like, yeah. He was like, yeah. And so they had been in the program probably about a week or two, and they're seeing each other every day, and then realize, like, you know, he looks like my cousin, but, you know, I don't know.
That's my favorite story between
yeah.
them.
Yeah, that's so crazy.
How do they not know?
And they're looking at each other, and they know each other, but they still was kind of, like, you know, iffy about it. And so after that, that's how they started, you know, communicating with each other more. So senior year, Walt started hanging more, you know, after they went to prom and all kind of stuff. They started hanging together, and Walt went away to college. And so when he went away to college, all he's talking about, he can't wait to get home. I've been working on music with the boys, you know, all summer. We've been doing this. We've been going here. We've been doing that. And so that's when they really started working a lot.
You know, some of the moments from Prom King on Saba's project,
mm-hmm.
you know. I mean, when you – I guess I'm jumping around a little.
That's all right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, but when you heard that, I mean, what was your – For I mean, maybe you heard it before. I'm sure you heard it before it came out.
I did not.
Oh, you
did? Prom King?
Yeah.
Oh, no. Malik wouldn't let me listen to it. He kept telling me, he kept warning me that it was a song and it was pretty deep. But he said, I just had to put it out there. And I did. And I'm like, okay, you know. And he warned me. And I'm like, but once we were listening to the song, I heard it at the listening party for the first time. That was the week before he actually dropped the album. And when we were listening to it, everybody was kind of laughing and snickering, really just listening to a conversation between him and Walt. That's what it seemed like when we were listening to this song for the first time. And then when it started getting up into the point where, you know, things started to take a turn, and you start realizing it's about to go into the point when we lost them, then everybody in the room just kind of got silent. And it just broke everybody down, because we relived that. And it's like, I put this kid, I put him a squeak in the middle of what I was going through. But it's, you know, and I kept beating myself up. Man, they had to go through this with me. They had to go look for Walt with me. They did this and they did that. But later on, I started thinking, it wouldn't be any other way. If I wouldn't have called them, they probably would have been mad. Like, why didn't you call us? And so they went through that with me that day. Malik, Squeak, they was working really hard with me, just trying to figure out where he was. And we were just searching and searching, and we found him. They found him before I did. And
and you know, Joseph talks about that day on you know, his Corner Store episode. You've become kind of the mother of the Pivot Gang in a lot of ways. And so how soon after John's thing did you know that you wanted to do something in his name? What is that process like of going from such a obviously insurmountable, inexplicable loss to wanting to do something that holds his name and his legacy so high?
You know, it was crazy. It wasn't at his funeral. Everything was just numb. Looking at my child in that white box, he was in a white box with a white suit. And, you know, it's just like, he's not, you know, I kept thinking it was a dream that I was going to wake up from. And I wasn't able to wake up from this dream. And so everything around me, I don't remember. I don't remember who I talked to. I don't remember who was there. I don't remember anything. I don't remember the singing. Just 2 days later, I'm sitting there, and I hear my pastor's sermon. And in his sermon, he started talking about the woman that had an issue of blood in the Bible, and that she really wanted to be cured. She wanted to be healed. And the way that she could do it was to touch the hem of Jesus. And so he compared that to Walt. He said that woman tried to be in her own lane. And he used like a quote from interview that Walt was doing for, I don't even know what he was doing it for. I think it was for like a release of his song or something, to Roll With Me. And he was talking about violence, and he was talking about being in his own lane, and talking about trying to make people happy with his music. That was the interview that he took that from. And he was like that this woman was trying to be in her own lane, and Walter was in his own lane. And so I'm sitting there thinking, I'm like, man, I even remember that he said this, you know, 2 days later, because everything else was just a blur. I didn't remember anything. And I'm like, well, my baby tried to make a lane for himself. He tried to make a lane for other people, because everybody that I meet that knew him, they always tell me how encouraging he was to them.
The biggest cheerleader.
Yeah. Yeah, he would motivate them to do, you know, whatever, like listen to my, you know, my music while telling me. And, you know, he was like, oh, don't do that. You know, try to switch it up, or, you know, just something that was encouraging to them to make sure that they were going to be on top with whatever they're doing. So it was just like the motivation from that. And I'm like, man. And he always told me, I used to say, well, I need you to get another job, because I'm tired of working two jobs. You're the oldest. I need you to help me. And he was like, you know what, Mom? I'm going to buy you a big house and a red car. Just believe in me. And I'm like, okay. You know, when he said those words, just believe in me, and I still believe in him.
Yeah.
He wanted to make a way, and he wanted to do something to better himself. And so to better himself, me believing in him, his dream, I know there's other kids out there that have dreams, that want to push into a career in the arts, push, you know, their career in, you know, business or whatever. But my baby was an artist. And so the people that was around him were all artists. And so his community was so large. My sister always laughs. Like, we would take him places. I'd drop him off. He'd say, Mom, take me to Wicker. And I'd take him to YCA. Mom, take me to Wicker. And I'd drop him off, you know, someplace. And, you know, he's doing some things. And she said, we didn't really realize that Walt had a real community of friends, for real. And he has a wonderful group of friends. I've never seen such a great bunch of kids that just like hug and embrace each other every day. They don't have to hug each other literally, but they do with the things that they do. Every concert that I've been to in the past year, every event, all of those guys are together, and they come out and support each other the same way he did. So I just really feel like we need more kids in our community to be like the people that I've been meeting since the day my son passed away.
His passing had a really large effect on Chicago's rap community. Mm-hmm. Like, a lot of people, you know, a lot of people were really, really sad. And I feel like, you know, Pivot Gang has really come together and done a lot of amazing things mm-hmm. in that.
He was in a lot of spaces, and I think you're right that he was somebody who also navigated and encouraged other people. Mm-hmm. The John Wall Foundation is encouraging other young people. So if you can talk a little about what is the goal or the mission of the foundation.
And you also awarded the recently. So if we could talk about, I mean, they have projects they pitched.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So the John Wall Foundation, we're just empowering the youth in the city of Chicago, the ones that are interested in the arts. We're actually doing scholarships for them. So each year we're going to do 5 scholarships. And if we grow and can do something bigger, we will, you know. But right now we're starting small, and we're doing 5. We did this year 5 kids each to do a scholarship for them. The scholarship is for whatever they do in their arts. So it's not like it's an academic scholarship. Both Walter and Saba had the academic scholarships that they had to keep their GPA at a certain level, and they had to do this and all these different stipulations and everything. And I don't think either one of them liked it a lot. It was just like too much on them. You know, I want to just do my schoolwork and get it over with and keep going. But they felt like with the scholarship, it was like, I'm expected to be at this level all the time. And you just can't be who you are when you got somebody with their foot on your neck,
right,
you know, trying to force your, you know, and you can be a smart person, but just feeling like, you know, I just have to do this, that pressure was kind of hard on both of them, and I don't think they liked it. So
you guys give artistic grants, really,
just, yeah,
you know, based on the project. Mm-hmm. You reward $1,000 to across genres, mm-hmm. to allow young people to kind of fulfill some of their creative dreams.
Yeah, so with the kids that we selected this year, we had we started out, we had like maybe 20 applicants once we opened up the application process. So we didn't want to just do the 20 kids. So we put it back out there again, and then we didn't get a big response again. But then the last time we put it out there, we got 160 applicants. So we reviewed all of these applicants, and we had a great bunch of people to look through the applications. And each one of the kids had to upload a portfolio. So with their portfolio, it was just whatever their work was. So, like, if you're a singer, you know, a video of you singing, or, you know, a song that you submitted. It had to be something original. A poet or writer, they had to write a piece or whatever. Any kind of artist, a visual artist, just show us what you did. And we picked, I want to say about 40 kids that we interviewed the first time, but a lot of them didn't come to the interview, and we were shocked about that. And then the second time, we had a bunch of kids to come, and then some of them didn't come to the interview. And, you know, they said they were going to come, but they didn't. And we had found our
Incredible crew, a very talented crew, including Marlena.
Marlena, who's my old intern.
Yeah, that's right.
Marlena was amazing. We really liked her off the bat.
She's a good writer.
Did they pitch a project that they're working on?
Well, it wasn't a project that they pitched. So what they did was they uploaded, you know, their work, and then when we interviewed them, they came, and it wasn't like American Idol type thing or anything like that, but we had them to come, and the people in the room just had them, you know, ask them a few questions to see what they really want to do, to see if they were really passionate about their particular art and what they want to do. And then we're going to do mentors for each one of the kids. So it was like, what do you want your mentor to show you? And then they told us about those different things. And then the last thing we did was have them to do whatever they do. So if you were a singer, go ahead and sing for us. If you
so it's a little like American Idol.
Yeah, it was like a little bit. Like, we didn't want it to be like American Idol, but we just wanted to see how passionate and that they were about their art. Every kid that came through there was passionate about their art. So it was a very hard decision that was made when we selected the we call them fellows. It was very hard, and it took us weeks to try to determine which ones that we were going to get, because it was just like everybody just had such a great passion and drive, and they had Walt-like qualities, every last one of them. So when we had to turn some folks down, I was
it's hard,
oh,
yeah.
Yeah, I don't want
no,
to
but
turn
it's,
this
it's
down.
Incredible what you guys are doing. Now, of course, you have the second annual John Walt Day is coming up soon, November 24th. The Concord, right? So if you got to scalp your tickets now. If you do scalp your tickets, though, kick back that loot to the John Walt Foundation. But tell us a little about John Walt Day and what people could maybe expect this year.
Oh, I don't know what I can tell
you.
All
right.
Because, you know, we coming big. We came big last year. We got to come bigger, this year. Make sure that we can make Walt's name live, celebrate his life, and make sure that we can get the funding that we needed to be able to pay out for those scholarships, because that was the first thing that we talked about was the scholarships, and then we moved forward into the foundation.
Because ticket proceeds that night go to benefit.
Directly.
Yes, right.
Yeah, they go directly to the scholarship. Right. And that's how we're going to fund the scholarship for each one of the kids. If you want to make donations, you can all make donations at the John Walt Foundation, www.johnwaltfoundation, and just go to the link to donate, because we're going to do more than just the scholarships. We want to do workshops and everything for the kids as well. Everything that we can do to make sure that the kids have barriers removed from them not being able to pursue their career in the arts. We just want to remove certain barriers. So, like, one thing, Walt and Saba and Joseph and Fresh and Mello and Squeak, they live on the west side. We're all from the Austin area. And so being in the Austin area, the kids didn't really have any place to do their arts. They didn't have any place to go. So they ended up downtown at Unimedia. They ended up down at YCA, which I'm glad that they ended up at those two places. But the same token, they didn't have any place to go, so they had to go outside. So we want to try to eventually be able to build enough that we can get a space on, in the Austin area, so kids don't have to commute and go so far. And definitely just have some place to be.
That's awesome.
To do some positive.
For sure. Now,
I'm so inspired right now.
I know. Yeah. Nichelle, where could people find you and the John Walt Foundation other than the website on the internets?
John Walt Foundation on Facebook. And then we're on Twitter and Instagram. Don't get me to tell you a story about my handles for Instagram and Twitter, but I think it's like John Walt
FDN.
FDN.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah.
John Walt FDN, both on Twitter and Instagram. And, just follow us. And, you know, you can make donations. Please make donations because we want to do big things for other people. We want to give back to the kids. And we need, you know, being a nonprofit organization, you know, you live off of donations. You know, we can't make this happen for kids without people helping us out. And we're struggling. We're learning, and we're doing everything that we can to make it possible for the kids. So,
well, you're an inspiration, Nichelle. Thank you so much for being in the corner store. Make some noise for Nichelle one time. Thank you so much. Thank you for the snacks as well.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, turning the tables.
I got snacks.
Appreciate you. Thank you so much. November 24th on Walt Day at the Concord Music Hall. So make sure you go and support and follow the John Walt Foundation and donate on the website. Thank you so much. Yeah.
What, you know what I didn't say?
Oh, no. But
pivot.
Please.
So y'all know I have to say that when I walk into a room. One more time. Pivot. All right.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right, y'all. So our second guest is someone who has ran last year and has been an organizer, is an organizer, an advocate, an activist in the city of Chicago in her second campaign for mayor. I think, you know, in my estimation, an incredibly important voice in the city, a viable and progressive candidate. I would say probably one of the only progressive candidates that we have in this field. Restore on the second night of our first year anniversary. Please make some noise for Amara Enya. Amara, welcome.
Good to be here.
Thank you so much for being with us.
Yeah,
appreciate
thank you.
We have some snacks for you as well. So don't get it twisted. I don't know if you delight in such things, but some Reese's peanut butter cup minis.
Okay,
enjoy those.
Those are fine.
And then
thank you.
These are, you know, I think Max was looking out for you because you know, these are good health sea salt veggie straws. So I, those are in your lane. Yeah,
Max
is a snacker. I could also put those unless you want to enjoy those now. Feel free.
No, because I know I'm going to get some chocolate.
Yeah, okay, I'll hold those for you over here. And of course, we also have a hat and a t-shirt for you as well.
Thank you, I appreciate it.
Yeah,
I was just telling Kevin you're the most official grown person I feel like we've had on the podcast.
Oh, wow.
You're just so official.
I'll take it.
Yeah,
I'll
you have a good speaking voice.
Oh, thank you.
Well,
oh,
right.
Wow.
She uses it often, especially
yes,
these days.
Absolutely. Especially these days, yes.
So, Amara, so we want to talk about a lot of things, but we want to know, you know, you. And so, you know, who you are and where you come from and get more about your story. And so, if you don't mind, maybe we could start there. Where are you from?
Sure. So, I live on the west side of Chicago, so I had to give props to Nichelle for, she says she's from Austin, lives on Warren. I live on Warren, actually, so I have to proudly represent that side of town. My growing up years were actually split between the north side, Rogers Park, Uptown, Edgewater area, and the suburbs. So my father had a teaching job at Governor State University, so it required us to be in the suburbs. But my family is from Nigeria. And for those of you who know the Uptown Rogers Park area, it is where all of the immigrants pretty much from everywhere around the world
live. It's a port
live.
Uptown, yeah.
Yes, it is. It is like the headquarters. So I spent most of my growing up years there. Up under the Wilson Red Line, there was a spot called the Equator Club. I don't know if anyone is familiar with the Equator Club.
What was going on there at the Equator Club? I mean, let's break it down a little bit. You know, like what were you privy to, maybe?
During daytime hours.
Okay.
During daytime hours, it was actually a place where we had a lot of our community meetings. Even in the Nigerian community, we had our baby showers. I used to do traditional dance when I was younger, so that's where we learned how to dance. That's where we did our organization meetings, our town meetings. I wasn't there when it was, you know, the real club.
Allegedly.
But it was I know. Right?
Right, yeah.
But it was actually over the years when it was founded, it hosted a lot of international artists, and it was a really dope spot. So that is one of the earliest memories that I have, is really just that whole area on Broadway. We had the Twin Towers right off Lakeshore Drive that we used to be at all the time. I played soccer on the north side since I was like 4 years old. So the part of the city that really resonates with me and my earliest memories.
I mean, it seems like a pretty tight-knit community, too.
Definitely. So for those of us as a first generation, there is an experience that we share regardless of where your family comes from. There's just something about having to navigate different cultures. So we have one culture in the home, and then we had to navigate the culture here. So immigrants from anywhere, whether it's Mexico, India, wherever, the same experience as those of us who are born here, grew up here, but find ourselves having to straddle different cultural contexts. And I think it's part of the reason why, for me, always having been a bridge builder, someone who is a bridge between cultures, between communities, between generations, because you are just situated that way in this life because of our upbringing.
Was it difficult for you to transition from, you know, is it a culture shock to go from that, you know, home to the outside?
Yes. Well, so the thing is, there are the more traumatic experiences. So, for example, I used to wear my hair very short, like shaved completely, because back home, you were up until a certain age, you didn't grow your hair out. So I had, like, my hair was completely shaved. This is when I was maybe 7 or 8 years old. So you can imagine, that was when my parents rationed out, well, this is how we always do it. So, of course, we had to do it. Now, going into a school with kids who don't always have the cultural sensitivity, well, it was just a completely different story. So there was a lot growing up of the kind of teasing. I used to have a very strong accent where it was very strong. Now it's disappeared over the years, but that was a point of difference. And for young people, especially children, we tend to hone in on difference. And because they haven't necessarily gotten the, you know, politically correct or any of that, then it can make it a bit of a challenge, especially when you're trying to navigate how things are in home and then how things are outside of home.
Yeah, indeed. Now, your father taught. What did your mom do?
So she is a clinical psychologist. So both of my parents, and actually a lot of my activism started from them. Both of my parents have been activists for generations. They fought in Nigeria's Civil War in 1967, or commemorated, rather, the 50th anniversary of that war. We are Igbo, and so my father was a battalion commander, I believe, in that war. He was 21 years old, and the reason why he enlisted was there was a genocide that was taking place, and millions of Igbo people were being killed. There was a call out to all Igbo people around the world to come back home. And so they were already home, and so he enlisted, and my mother was a nurse. And it was always about the issues of justice, of human rights, of standing up for people, of having these values that you have an obligation to uphold. And so even after they came to the United States, they continued their activism and organizing against the government. We had dictators in Nigeria in the years following, up until the 90s. And they continued organizing here in Chicago, the community, against executions that were taking place, a lot of human rights violations that were taking place. And so myself and my five siblings, we wrote the press releases. I had to type my father's book that he was writing, because that's what the kids are there for.
Wow.
Apparently.
Yeah.
Are you in high school when this is happening?
I might have been in eighth grade, or maybe I was a freshman or a sophomore in high school.
Are you a ghostwriter? You get credit.
So what he did is he wrote out his entire book on yellow pads, and then I would have to decipher his handwriting.
Wow.
Type of the book. So that's how it happened.
Well, I guess I want to jump ahead a little bit.
Yeah,
but
sure.
You said you grew up in the south suburbs, between the south and north side, but you seem to be a huge advocate for the west side, and you live on the west side. So.
Yes. So I, as long as I've lived in Chicago, meaning when I came back, I went to U of I Urbana, and when I came back to Chicago and started working, I've always lived on the west side. I've always felt connected to that part of the city. And it's really inexplicable, but I've always been drawn to that part of the city. Now, I worked in government. I worked in the mayor's office, in the Daley administration. And one thing that stuck out to me was that we never talked about the West Side. It was almost as though it didn't exist. And that was always a very curious thing. But if you look at the investment patterns in the city over time, even the South Side gets, you always hear about the South Side and this and that. But on the West Side, it was almost as though there's this vacancy, as though it doesn't exist. And so when I left City Hall, I intentionally went to work on the West Side because of what I saw as a lack of attention to this part of town. And I also live there. Now, I tell anyone, it is... my neighborhood is just in a gorgeous neighborhood, like some of the best housing stock in the city. We have parks, we have access to infrastructure. The value is there, but what is not valued is the people who currently live there. And that's why we see the disparity in investment, the disparity in attention, the disparity in resources, because when the power structure doesn't value the people that live in an area, then the investment follows that.
Yeah.
And so for me, I always talk about the West Side, even as my work expanded across the city and internationally, because it is a part of the city that for so long has been ignored, and we constantly have to be boosting it so that it can be on the radar of people who make decisions about how resources are allocated in the city.
Well, it's what Nichelle said earlier, right, that there's institutional deprivation
yes.
on the West Side,
yes.
even in a way that there isn't on the South Side. Obviously, there is also, you know, grand inequity there, too.
Yes.
But on the West Side, there is, historically, as you say, a lack. So you left City Hall to become an organizer on the West Side. What did you go to the, you know, what was that first foray into kind of West Side organizing or politics like for you?
So if you learn organizing on the West Side, you can do it anywhere in the world. I have to say that. That is largely where I cut my organizing teeth here. I was doing organizing even when I was in college and undergrad. But in Chicago, I went to work for an organization. I became the executive director of an organization called Austin Coming Together. And I essentially had to build that organization from scratch. And it was built around this notion of collaboration and how do you get area to work cohesively around improvements in a community. And so now the organization has just received, I think it was a $1 million grant from the MacArthur Foundation because of the work that we did around education, around economic development and employment, and around early childhood education. So that is something that was, when I became executive director, there was no structure to it. So it was build it up from scratch. I also was working in the advanced manufacturing sector, and I was doing these two jobs simultaneously. So
okay.
You'll notice a pattern. I tend to
take on a lot.
Yes.
Yeah. You do the most.
But I was working in the advanced manufacturing sector because the West Side used to have a very strong manufacturing base historically. You'll see a lot of the vacancies, factories that are empty as the economy changed and companies closed down. But there are still many available in the economy that don't necessarily require a college degree, but if you have the skill sets, you can get jobs in those sectors.
So what were you making on the West Side?
Well,
you said you were in the manufacturing.
So I was actually if you'll notice, across the country, there was this resurgence of paying attention to manufacturing as a vital sector. We had moved away from that for years because it was this, everyone goes to college. We don't do manufacturing. We outsource that to other countries. And then we realized that we actually were falling behind countries like Germany, like Spain.
Well, we lost a whole middle class who pushed NAFTA through the Clinton White House in the 90s, right?
Exactly.
So those jobs and middle class status in a city became not necessarily viable anymore.
Exactly, you know? Exactly. And there was no push to actually bring them back.
Right.
So my role, I actually was doing this work nationally. So we were definitely doing it on the West Side, in Austin in particular, but I was managing projects in Oakland. I was doing a lot of work in D.C. So if you notice, when President Obama all of a sudden started talking about manufacturing, it was that. In this growth that came out in 2012, the number one issue on that was investing in expanding the advanced manufacturing sector, both from a jobs and corporations and businesses standpoint, but also from a workforce development standpoint. So that was a lot of the work that I was doing on the policy side and the workforce side. Currently, I still serve as executive director of the Austin Chamber of Commerce. Chamber is not a traditional chamber. Through that, we have several large-scale development projects that we've initiated. I do a lot of work in entrepreneurship. We're piloting a lot around cooperative businesses and cooperative economic models, and we get a chance to do a lot of that there. So I'm still very much connected to the community because that's where I live. And even as my work has expanded, I'm always going to keep some ties to the neighborhood.
So at what point are you looking around? You're doing these multiple activities. Like, you know what? Fuck it. I'm going to run for mayor. Like, what? Like, at what point do you also take that on as an idea?
Oh, you know, I just woke up one day.
Right. You're like, I need another gig. I mean,
right.
Yeah.
Right. Well, you know, there is a stereotype around that, too. You know, if you haven't heard that, there's Africans and Jamaicans tend to have like 3 or 4 jobs. It's a stereotype. I'm very much following the stereotype.
Yeah,
I don't think I've heard that one actually. It's not just, I just figured that's all immigrant.
We all do the most. So the decision to run for mayor for me was very much an internal decision. I think that at the time there was this fear, this culture of fear in the city. Like, you dare not challenge an incumbent, you challenge a political machine, you dare not challenge the status quo. I reject that. I just reject it. Largely because I had seen what happens at the top level of government because I worked at the top level of government. And because I live in the neighborhood and the issues that I talk about are not theoretical, they are actual lived experiences of my neighbors and myself. And the way that we were raised, again, was that we have a responsibility, that we don't wait for other people to do what we know we can do ourselves. It was an internal decision because most folks would dare not bother. And it's, quite frankly, it's easy to just say, well, I'll let someone else do that. Or do I really want to expose myself to the scrutiny? There are a lot of less stressful and more lucrative things that I could be doing than running for mayor.
Yeah. Doesn't pay well.
It doesn't.
Yeah.
It doesn't pay well.
Yeah.
But there's a vision for the city and what the city can be.
So break it down. What is your vision? Because this is your second time in.
Yes.
So what is your vision moving forward for the city and why you've also entered the race again?
Yes. So the vision that I have is, it's not even a one vision that comes out of my mind. It is the collective, all of the people that I've worked with, organized with, talked with over the years who deserve to have their vision actualized. I think that's the difference between this campaign and other campaigns, is that it's less about one person looking for a job, and it's more about how do we actualize a vision that people of Chicago deserve. And that vision is contrary to what we now see and experience. So it is one where I don't have where I'm going to live, because if I live in a certain neighborhood, my child will not have access to a good school or a school, right? It is the fundamental belief that we have everything that we need to create a high quality of life for every Chicagoan. I actually believe that. If you think about a $9 billion budget, and you think about how that money is allocated, how those resources are allocated, there are certain folks who are doing quite well in the city. My premise is that we always should operate from a position of abundance. The message that we are told and taught is about scarcity. But what happens is the scarcity only affects those of us who aren't in the corridors of power. Because there are some who are doing quite well and living abundantly in the city. I fundamentally believe that everyone has the opportunity to live abundantly in this city. And if we actually had that philosophy, it would affect how we invest economically, where we invest economically, what we think or believe about education and everyone's right, especially every child's right to a quality education, what we believe about people being able to access that housing is fundamental, it is foundational. It would affect the things that we access to mental health resources, access to safety, the right to live in a community that is not polluted because the city changed regulations to make sure that industrial companies are coming in and allowed to excrete pollutants in certain neighborhoods, which are always black and brown neighborhoods. Yeah. Like, these are things that within the structure that exists, and our responsibility is to reject that premise, but not just to reject it or to critique it, but to say, here's the alternative. and here's what we can actually build, because our responsibility is to be builders, we're creators. We recognize that there is a paradigm that is actually declining before our very eyes. As you look at what's happening with privatization, the trend of losing 250,000 black people alone in 15 years, that's telling you something about this current paradigm. It is not sustainable. So our responsibility is to say, what do we build to take its place? And that's what this campaign represents.
What have you learned between the first time you ran and this time? I mean, maybe a tough question.
That our message is still just as relevant, if not more so, today than it was 4 years ago. That what didn't exist 4 years ago was this national and even international wave of anti-establishment sentiment. What didn't exist 4 years ago was to chip away at the sense of inevitability about the way things are. That didn't exist 4 years ago. And so you're almost yelling into the about something that you can see that everyone else can't quite see. But a lot has happened over the last 4 years. I mean, just look at who's in the White House, you know?
Yeah.
And look at other people, insurgents, who have been willing to take the risk to challenge the status quo in whatever context. And so for me, the biggest thing is that we were right on time. We just had, the world had to sort of catch up. There were hard lessons from the first time. It's the first time I had never run for office before. It's never been a lifelong dream of mine to be an elected official. And so there are just some realities about what it means to engage in politics in Chicago that were hard lessons. We had, you know, everything from the fundraising and the need to raise money to we had our campaign offices destroyed, burglarized a week before petitions were due. I remember being followed while I was campaigning, you know, me, the unlikely candidate. Like, those are hard lessons from that first time that this time around we take into account and we recalibrate and we do what we need to do.
Well, that attention has only increased, of course, particularly of late. You've had a few major notable endorsements.
So the endorsements that we had Chance the Rapper who endorsed us. That was huge. We also had support by Kanye, which was also big. Both of those things happened sort of out of the blue, if you will. For Kanye, it was literally an out-of-the-blue phone call on my cell phone. And apparently it was a time when he was talking about he was coming back to Chicago, he wanted to find a way to help the neighborhood, he was going to purchase his mom's old house and all of this. And so apparently my name had been circulating. He kept hearing my name come up in these different conversations, and so he said he had to reach out to me. He wanted to talk to me. So someone gave him my number, and he called me out of the blue, and he said, "Hi, this is Kanye." And I said, "Oh, hi."
Because what do you really say?
I mean, what do
Kanye
you say?
Tells you, yeah.
Yes. But we had a good conversation about what it looks like to invest in the city, some of the things that he's been able to do outside of the city back, and to have this sort of expansive vision for the city that wasn't limited was quite refreshing. And so we had that conversation. And with Chance, it was similar. Chance and I had never met formally, but we found ourselves in the same spaces. A lot of the organizing that I was doing, whether it was on No Cop Academy or education equity issues in CPS, sometimes he'd be in the same city council meeting and he'd be giving a comment and I'd be sitting in the back. And so he also reached out and was like, "Yeah, you know, I've been following your work for a long time. I rock with you. I want to talk about your vision for the city and what we can do." And that was how that conversation started. So the thing that I take away is that you do the work and you never know who sees you doing the work. And I believe that when people are doing the work, they gravitate toward each other. And so that's been a lot of my experience. Like, a lot of the people that I have worked with and organized with, we sort of find each other in the process of doing the work. And so those endorse the same way.
Yeah. Now, moving forward, you know, part of the listenership, I think, of the Corner Store is a young generation of creatives in the city and beyond. But what can people who want to be involved with what you're doing, how can they help, and how can they help get you elected?
Yeah, so this is the shameless plug part, y'all.
Good. No, I like it. Please make it.
No, we are really excited. This campaign is It is awesome. The level of enthusiasm and excitement, quite frankly, that existed before the endorsements, there was just this enthusiasm that people have because they're attracted to the spirit of the campaign and this excitement about what we can do in the city. So the campaign is incredibly diverse. It's different. We're not conventional. So if you're looking for conventional, you can talk to the other elsewhere. 90 candidates.
Yeah, right.
But anyone who's interested, amaraenya.com, that is AmaraEnya.com. We have our calendar. You can sign up to become a volunteer. You can get our weekly newsletter that we send out. We're also on all of the social media platforms. And so you can reach out, you can send messages to us on there. We have a whole team that responds directly to people. We have our calendar of events also, and we encourage you to attend our public events. The other thing that we're really doing now over the next few weeks is we've been doing these pull-ups that we've done. We did one on 63rd and Cottage Grove a couple of weeks ago, and that was to talk about displacement and gentrification and the need for community benefits agreements on development projects in Chicago, including with the Obama Presidential Center. I'm going to put that out there.
No, let them know.
So we also did one downtown where we were talking about economic justice and what happens when fines, fees, and tickets force some people into bankruptcy and to move out of the city and what we can do about that. We'll be doing one coming up on the west side. We will be on Madison and Pulaski.
Hey.
I'm excited about that. We're going to be right out in the neighborhood. I don't even know what we're going to be talking about at that one, but we're just excited to be right out just talking to people directly. And we'll be at college campuses also, DePaul, Malcolm X, Harold Washington College. All of this is happening in this coming week. So again, all of that information is on our website. It's on our social media.
Wait, and what is the socials? What are the socials?
So everything is Amara Enya. Instagram, it's Amara for Chicago. On Facebook, I think the handle to get to our page is Amara for Chicago. So if you hit that up, you can get plugged in and follow all of our events and join the campaign. It's really a dope campaign, y'all.
All right. Make some noise for Amara one time. Maybe one more. Maybe one more. You're okay to take? All right. So we're going to open the microphone up in a moment. So if you do have a question, so make sure, though, that you keep your question to a question. I don't want to speak for Amara. I don't know if she wants to listen to your mixtape, but make sure that it is a relevant and relatively brief question. So please, if you do have a question, line up. I do have a question for you before we go to our audience. In the midst of all of this, how do you maintain what do you do to get your mind in a different kind of space in order to focus on, the import of the work that you do in the world?
Yeah, that's a good question. So it can be very campaigning is no easy thing. Like I did the first time I ran, I was doing basically 4 a.m.s to midnights for over a year, just because there's so much to get out in front of people and to talk to people and all of that. So I have to make sure that I'm mentally prepared, especially because when you're doing things for the right reason, it just means something different. Like you're really putting everything into it. So I have to make sure that I protect my time as much as possible. I'm a runner. Well, I'm also a biker and a swimmer. So I guess I do all of
Iron
those
Man?
Things.
Yeah.
Yes. So I can't train for an Ironman now because I don't have the time. But I definitely still do run every morning. I still do my 4 a.m.s. I get on the bike. If I can't be outside now that it's getting cold, I'm inside. I swim for as long as I need to. And I have to do that consistently. There's a certain discipline that's necessary when you're doing this kind of work because you have to be your best self in order to get this done, in order to do what you're doing. And so I try to keep that in the back of my mind and keep those routines so that I can be healthy and present and sane to make sure that we see this through to the very end.
Outstanding. Good. All right. I don't see folks lining up to ask a question. Y'all are flunking in that category. Thank you, Matt Muse, to be the first to ask a question. Please introduce yourself and say where you're from as you ask Amara a question.
Hi, I'm Matt Muse. I am from the south side of Chicago. Is that what you meant, like from?
Thank you, Matt.
Okay, I'm from the south side of Chicago. I have a two-part question. One, J.B. Pritzker, right, just won governor of Illinois, and he's discussed this idea of, like, legalizing marijuana and
Our producer Ernie is very excited.
Well,
about Pritzker or marijuana? I don't know. Maybe splitting a Dutch with Jason Pritzker.
But yeah, about legalizing marijuana, right? I am concerned with, and I've always been concerned with that conversation about folks who have been incarcerated or are in jail awaiting, you know, going to prison for the sale and distribution of marijuana and how legalizing it plays into that. So I want to know your thoughts on that. Also, $94 million Cop Academy, school closed. Thoughts on that? Cool.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. So on the legalizing marijuana, I have always felt very strongly that, number one, it's not necessarily the panacea I think that it's being made out to be. But if we're going to do it, there has to be a mechanism to actually make sure that those who have been harmed when it was illegal actually can participate in that in the economy, the business, the entrepreneurship side of it once it becomes legal. There are a couple of models that actually work well. If anyone is familiar with what's happening in Oakland, so who are coming out of the system, that now they can become entrepreneurs in the marijuana industry and they get all of the handholding and the resources and supports to have legitimate marijuana businesses. I think that same thing has to apply because it was used for so long as a mechanism to push people into the prison system. You cannot have legalization without that being part of the conversation. The other thing that's happened in Illinois even is when you talk about medical marijuana and licensing, to where if you're not, don't have a few hundred thousand dollars, you cannot participate in this sector, which to me is completely wrong. It represents the historical pattern of those who have benefited, who were harmed when it was illegal, and then those who were never harmed but are able to benefit once it is legal. That has to be looked at as well, and I hope that the governor actually takes those things into account. On the $95 million for the Cop Academy, again, I have always stood with the organizers. I have to shout out Good Kids Mad UIP. I have to shout out all the organizations that have been standing solidly. Asada's Daughters, yes, on No Cop Academy. And for people to understand that it's not just we don't want the Cop Academy. It is a critique on the investment disparity in the city. And that if you are really interested in addressing violence, right, that requires investment. Investment in communities that have been disinvested. So in my neighborhood, because they're putting it, you haven't invested economically for how many decades? But now this Cop Academy is being touted as economic investment. To me, which is, that is insidious. Because you'll notice that whenever it comes to our communities, when we talk about investment, they always talk about violence, number one. And so the investment is always in police infrastructure. We don't necessarily need that academy there. What we need is investments in abating public health hazards like exposure to lead. We need investment in the schools that exist there so that they can be brought up to the standards that everyone should expect and deserve. We need investment in an economy that actually is inclusive, where the guys on my block actually have a way of getting into the overground economy. That's what naturally reduces violence and addresses violence so that we don't need to rely on more police in our neighborhoods, yeah. Right? So that is what academy means. And it is why I firmly stand with the organizers and stand with the groups that have been saying it, because that message needs to get across to the city of Chicago, the aldermen who all voted in favor of it except one. That's the message that we're trying to send.
All right, let them know. I'm also ready for a Mars mixtape, I think, actually, after this. Dominique James.
Hello, my name is Dominique. I'm also from the South Side. I'm going to follow Matt's example and give a two. Even though no one's waiting in line, I had a hella questions. So I'm going to make it cohesive as best as I can. So in the podcast earlier, you talked about this power structure that exists. And I'm curious, as someone who could be dismantling that power structure by practicing law, by researching education policy, given like your experience in those areas and like organizing, what makes you think that, or like being mayor, the most like effective way of dismantling that power structure? And similarly, you talked about the need to reimagine how we've been taught that the way things are is how they have to be, how they always will be. If we don't, which I don't think we have a lot of contrasting models, you have to reimagine that. And I'm wondering towards what models maybe you're drawing from, or what ancestors, what elders are you drawing from? Because I think there are people that have perhaps done that work of re-envisioning, and also the people around you that you draw from your community. I wonder who guides.
Thank you, Dominique.
Yeah, those are
good beautiful questions. Yeah. Not easy questions, though.
Yeah, well, they hardly ever are.
Yeah, true.
The office of mayor is critical because of the power of the executive. It is an office that wields an incredible amount of power in the city, and it has been used to create the current landscape, to what contracts are allowed or not allowed, to where schools are built, to pretty much across the board. It is an executive power, which is unlike city council, which is a legislative body. City council are essentially lawmakers, so they caucus each other to get legislation passed. The mayor wields an incredible amount of power, and the reason why the office of mayor is so crucial is because as someone who has organized on these issues for so many years, that was always the wall that we came up against. You can lobby this person and that person, but if the mayor puts pressure on the other side, then it halts. Those who were advocating for CPAC just found that out last week. Those who have been pushing even on No Cop Academy found that out. On the Obama Presidential Center found that out. These are positions that the mayor has the ability to actually make happen, but doesn't because of a fundamental difference in philosophy about what the city can be and whose city this is. So if you have a mayor who caters to only the wealthy, then every aspect of policy will follow that pattern, and it has. So I see this office and this fight as sort of the last battle for folks who've been on the battle lines for at least 8 years. That we cannot, in this precise moment, say, okay, we've got to sit this one out, because we've been fighting too hard. And I think about the long nights, the meetings in the basement, at some point, we have to scale the wall. And so running for office, running for mayor is about scaling the wall. Now, it is also about institutionalizing a different form of governance. Right? So it means that there are models like people's assemblies that work, that create more accountability from people actually living in their neighborhoods. We can institutionalize that. There should be much more transparency. Every alderman should be interested in building independent political and civic power in their wards. Yeah. And if that's not the top of your agenda as an alderman, then I already know you're not about anything. Because I want to know as mayor that if I call you in to do this is what I need done, that you're going to say, actually, my constituents have said this. Great, right? That's actually the model that's supposed to exist. It's supposed to be a strong council, weak mayor model. So instead of it, instead of having to rely on the benevolence of the person in the office, we actually have to institutionalize democracy. We have to institutionalize transparency. The only way you start to change the culture is by changing the people in these positions.
All right. I know Dominique had a second question about how you revision or reimagine city, and maybe even who are some of your examples or who are some of the people, mentors that also inspire you to do so.
Yeah, so a lot of the models that I look toward are, they're not even new. These aren't new models. When I talk about cooperative economic models, those existed in other communities, other countries for eons.
Yeah.
We're just getting hip to it now in Chicago. So we're actually behind the times, ironically, on some of the models that have actually been tried, tested, and true. So when I talk about community land trust as a way to halt displacement and making sure that there's ownership, collective ownership in communities. When I talk about a public bank, there one actually exists. It's the highest performing bank in the country. It's in North Dakota. And 15 other cities and states are actually implementing public banks because they recognize that traditional financial institutions have only taken money, extracted money out of public governments and have not put anything That's back right. into public government. So everything that I talk about, it is actually not something that needs to be started from scratch. Eons old. Some of it is generational. Some of it is just common sense. But it takes people who can think outside of this existing framework to say, okay, let's actually implement alternatives. And our campaign has always been about, we've always been the campaign of ideas and the solutions and actually putting them into practice.
Beautiful. We have time for one more question. I think, please. Yeah.
Hey, what's up? I'm Jared. I didn't grow up in Chicago, but I've been living out west for a few years. But honestly, a lot of people I know, they only know you because of the people that endorse you. And I was just wondering, with the people that endorse you, what goals and changes are y'all have in common and y'all are trying to focus on to change and make happen?
Yeah, so that's one of the wonderful things about the endorsement is that it actually put us on the radar of a lot of people who would not otherwise have been paying attention or who wouldn't have been able to do a little bit of deeper digging to find out more about the platform, what we care about. The good thing about those endorsements is that they're substantive. So, for example, Chance donated $1 million to CPS a few years ago because of this issue of quality programming and started Social Works, which is a foundation that does leadership development, et cetera, for young people. Kanye has talked about bringing factories, his factories that are now elsewhere, back to Chicago as a way to create jobs for people, because he's and this issue of investing in expanding mental health resources that both have actually talked about. So there's substance behind the endorsement. What the endorsement does, because our camp have never been who no one else bothers to engage or to bring into the political process, we want to expand the electorate. And if it takes hip-hop, if it takes celebrities to capture people's attention so that then they can get the message and the substance behind the campaign, then that's something that we're really leveraging, because what we're finding is that gets people engaged. And the engaged electorate is the one that can vote in their interest of the celebrity endorsement. And it's better because it's not just, they're not just a bunch of, you know, celebrities that just, hey, I'm so-and-so and I like this person. They have actually substantively contributed some things, and there's an alignment in terms of the vision for the city.
Well, one of the things that you've said too, that you noted about this past election most recently, is that a new number of millennials also engaged in the electoral process, which will be something that I think is important for your campaign.
Yes.
So, you know, it's an important portion of the electorate that you also want to speak with and to. How do you engage those folks? And what ways can they also maybe play a role in what you're doing?
Yeah, so we had record turnout for millennials, that age range, I think it's like 18 to 37, that came out in the highest number since 1986 in the midterms. A lot of that additional turnout was from organizations like Chicago Votes, like many organizations that were doing voter registration, they were doing voter education, they were out, they were registering people in the jails to vote. So they have been out doing that groundwork, and we work with a lot of those kinds of organizations because, again, this is a whole demographic that typically gets overlooked or people discount and say, oh, well, they're not going to come out to vote anyway. And so the value is that if they were that enthusiastic in the midterms, then when it comes to the mayoral and the municipal, which is directly affecting them, that we continue that momentum to get them engaged. Our goal is not just to compete for that 30% of likely voters that everyone else is competing for. Our goal is to expand the base of voters so that more people are participating in the process. And this midterm election was actually a telltale sign of what's to come. And so through our engaging people directly, whether it's through pull-ups, through public events, through all of those different mechanisms, they actually believe in.
True. Indeed, Amara, we're so excited for you, for your campaign, for what you do for and will continue to do for this great city. Thank you so much for being in the corner store. Make some noise for Amara, y'all. Tara.
Kevin.
It was a good one.
It was a good one.
Yeah.
I really like that West Side.
Indeed. We want to thank, of course, all of the good folks at Emporium, the Emporium Pop-Up, the staff here, Jorge, who got us here. We want to thank Stolen Spirits, our sponsor of the corner store. Note that your cocktail proceeds this evening will go to benefit the John Walt Foundation. We want to thank Nichelle Pugh for showing up. Make some noise for Nichelle again one more time. Yo, we want to thank DJ Exist for the beat.
Langston Olsen for the art.
Big ups, Todd Manley at WGN Radio.
And Max and Dami, the corner store interns.
Salutes to our super producer, DJ Cash Era.
You can keep in tune with the corner store at cornerstore_pod on Instagram, Twitter, and SoundCloud.
Also, you can stream and download the corner store wherever you listen to podcasts.
And please rate and subscribe and comment on iTunes.
Please, y'all, consider giving us those 5 stars.
Thank you for listening.
We're going to see you next week.
The Corner Store is brought to you by Stolen Spirits.